Hello, and welcome to the new episode of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, and I'm your host, Olga Breininger. Today, our guest is Jonathan Brooks-Platt of the University of Pittsburgh. Jonathan will be talking about his book, Greetings Pushkin, Stalinist Cultural Politics and the Russian National Bard, which was published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2016. In Greetings Pushkin, Platt focuses on the centennial celebrations of Pushkin's death in 1937 in the Soviet Union and shows how through the figure of Pushkin we can reconstruct the very complex sense of temporality and modernization specific of this period of Soviet history. Hello, Jonathan, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. We are very happy to have you with us today to talk about Greetings Pushkin, Stalinist Cultural Politics, and the Russian National Bard.
All right. Sounds good.
So how are you doing today?
Oh, not so bad. It's Friday. Nice autumn weather in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and so is in Boston. So traditionally, we first ask our speakers about their background. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
About myself. Well, in terms of my career in Slavism or just myself in general, my broad biographical.
We could do the broad biographical.
Okay, well, I don't know. I was born in the United States of America, and I traveled around a lot as a kid and as a young man, and I ended up an undergraduate in Berkeley, where I studied Russian literature and language. I started traveling to Russia. Then it was 1996 was the first time I went, and I've spent many years living there since then. I did my graduate school at Columbia in New York, and after that I went back to Russia for 5 years. I spent living in St. Petersburg, and I go to Petersburg a lot now, sometimes doing work with sort of the leftist crowd, different artists, poets, and philosophers and on the left in Russia, but mostly in St. Petersburg. And in 2010, I got the job here in Pittsburgh, and I've been here ever since, except for 1 year that I spent on leave in Petersburg again. I have two children, Isaac and Arkady. I don't know. What else do you want to know?
Maybe what got you interested in Russian studies?
I think it's quite probably similar to a lot of people. You know, I read the classic 19th century novels in high school already. And when I went to Berkeley, I basically decided to study Russian so that I could read these books that I liked in the original and eventually go to Russia and see what it was like there. And I never escaped that 17-year-old decision. But I don't know. I mean, I've always had really good professors. At Berkeley, my main professor was Olga Matich, who, you know, was really inspiring. And after I left college, I moved to Russia and taught English for a couple of years. And but I don't know. Olga kind of supported me in my idea of going to graduate school, which was good. So, and then at Columbia, I studied under Boris Gasparov, you know, who's amazing. And I think I took like 9 classes with him, so it was pretty influential. So it ended up being the only job I could get after that educational background.
So I think I mentioned in the preface to your book that it actually grew up off an undergraduate essay you wrote in Berkeley. So has it been almost a 20-year journey then with Pushkin?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, because I started, I don't know, I mean, it's kind of the logic behind the kind of the analysis that I do started really with this paper I wrote for Olga Matich in Berkeley. Also, Liza Knapp had a little bit of influence on it, I think, because she was the first person who told me to read Jakobson, and I had some kind of Jakobsonian metaphor and metonymy thing behind it. But yeah, and that just kind of evolved. I mean, it's also had all sorts of weird, I think I talk about in the preface how it has kind of personal things, like, you know, related to mood disorders and so on.
Yeah, that is actually really powerful.
Yeah, how I see myself as split between these kind of in the dissertation, it was ecstasy and elegy. And so this kind of mournful, depressed phase versus the more ecstatic manic phase. But I don't know. So, I mean, it was kind of a long, I was just in, you know, diving into, it started with modernist prose, but when I got to Columbia, I started getting interested in Stalinist culture. And yeah, so I was kind of using Stalinism as a form of self-therapy, I think, as much as producing a work of scholarship, which is kind of strange, but...
And I think that conceptually you moved quite far along from the metaphor and metonymy of Jakobson. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the theoretic framework of your book.
Yeah, no, I mean, it evolved a lot. I mean, the metaphor and metonymy thing was kind of what I did with it is I talked in terms of heroism, right? So I was comparing the prose. I mean, mostly the paper was about the prose of Pasternak and the early prose of Nabokov as being unheroic in its metonymic thrust, that there's a kind of reluctance to pursue this, you know, what Jakobson would associate with metaphors, this kind of more vertical unification of ideas that, you know, I think he relates to Mayakovsky mostly. But anyway, that kind of really persisted in a kind of this approach to the 1937 Jubilee as, you know, trying to understand how it was both a revolutionary event, both a continuation of the radical revolutionary impulse of Soviet society, but at the same time also an attempt to, you know, follow broader trends in Europe at the time and sort of anchor the new Soviet culture to the past in ways that had been resisted in the previous years. And so it kind of, which has, you know, in the history of the Soviet Union, Stalinism in particular, has been kind of seen as a kind of retreat from, the universalist kind of utopianism of the revolution of 1917 and avant-garde culture and a lot of different things like that. And so what I was trying to do was see how actually you could find two different attitudes, and I look at them in terms of temporality in the book. And you know, the final name for the two different types of temporality, or I talk about them as chronotopes using Bakhtin, is monumentalism and eschatology. Also problematic in some way, many ways, and people always jump on me for using the word eschatology, which doesn't fit if we look at it in its sort of prototypical meaning. But basically, what I do is I talk about how Pushkin, I mean, the simplest way of describing it is saying that Pushkin simultaneously is sort of living on as a monument that is kind of whose, our memory of the past, of this moment of foundation, this moment of origin, of, you know, the creation of the Russian literary language, all these kind of monumental achievements that are associated with Pushkin, that we kind of, as a culture, we preserve that memory, we return again and again to that sort of core of value in our culture in order to sort of anchor our identity as we move forward in time. And that's sort of the monumentalist approach but at the same time, Pushkin also is kind of living again, right? He's not just living on, but he's living again a new existence that is radically different from his own time, from his own life, that in some ways Pushkin is only, his legacy only really has come into being with you know, the Stalinist constitution of 1936 or the revolution or however you want to mark that, this fiery kind of apocalyptic threshold where the past, you know, has been judged now, which is a model that Boris Groys uses in his Stalin book. So some figures of the past are now consigned to the dustbin of history while others are brought forward in this kind of this leap across time, with through all sorts of different devices, showing Pushkin as being prophetically aware of the future revolution to come, the future society, you know, having artistic representations of Soviet people jumping back into time to rescue Pushkin from his untimely death, things like that. All sorts of different ways that they figure this. And I call it eschatological in the sense that there is a, I mean, partially because it has this apocalyptic quality to it, but also because it posits a kind of a different dimension of time from sort of linear everyday kind of, you know, clocks and calendars time that can be, that is founded on a principle of rupture, right? So that we can have some kind of extra temporal connection to Pushkin. We can imagine fusing our own revolutionary horizon with the horizon of his much darker time that was much further away from the revolutionary moment, but have some kind of contact with him as our, as a sort of, you know, a man, someone who fought for the same thing that we are fighting for and that we have achieved, right? So yeah, that's, I mean, the book kind of, that's the sort of overarching, you know, argument of the book, is that both of these things are happening simultaneously. Sometimes they're even fused in weird ways. So like the classic, the central metaphor or image in the book is that of Pushkin as a living statue, where you get both of these kind of attitudes to time simultaneously. On the one hand, he's this permanent monumental figure. But at the same time, it's a living thing. It's not just, it's not like a normal monument, which is kind of hollow and requires, you know, the attention of the crowd gathered around it to sort of give it an illusion of life, this metaphorical living on in our hearts or our memories or whatever. But with when the statue actually comes to life, typically in scenes where it's like communicating with the contemporary Soviet people, joining them in the celebrations, or like you'll have pictures of children reading Pushkin's poems to a statue of Pushkin, this kind of interesting tautological image. That there you are also getting this figure of, you know, Pushkin emerging from eternity into our present, or descending from some other realm into our to join us in our contemporary struggle, and that's what I describe as eschatological. So, but then alongside that, I also, you know, theoretical parts. Every chapter kind of adds little bits of other things, usually revolving around the question of modernity. I look at these attitudes to time in terms of the discourse of modernity and how both monumentalism and eschatology go back, you know, to the antiquity, but as ways of thinking about the modern, right? That the modern is not, doesn't just start with the Renaissance or the French Revolution or whatever you want to say. It as a concept, it goes back to late antiquity and Rome, and this kind of idea of what is our time and what is the relationship of our time to, for example, the great past, of, you know, the legacy of the past, or as you get into more medieval times, towards this kind of end that's coming. And the way I talk about it is that these two attitudes in the period that we call modernity or Nove Vremya in the Neuzeit in other languages, they become ambivalent to themselves. So you cannot you can't really relate the contemporary modern moment, our time, the threshold of the now, to some kind of static, fixed past or eternal realm that will, you know, eventually come to occupy. To replace our sort of profane temporality in an eschatological model, that those external kind of, that external past or that external future cease to kind of, they can't really dominate the present like they used to. The present acquires its own special value, and you start to get these weird interactions where so in sort of properly modern monumentalism, you return to the past in order to anchor, you return again and again. You have to keep going back. You get this kind of iterative quality where you have to keep going back to this kind of moment of origin that doesn't really have a kind of clear substance. And you go back in order to then go forward again, in order to sort of preserve identity as you go forward. Whereas, and the eschatological model and its ambivalence becomes this kind of similarly iterative kind of need to constantly introduce ruptures in time in order to sort of, you know, an avant-garde model, for example, to avoid reification, to avoid automatized perception or so on. You have to sort of introduce these ruptures, the love of novelty, of sort of flashes of the new. You have, you know, Baudelaire's definition of the modern as this as related to fashion, where you know specifically as a kind of flashing of the eternal within the present. That's his definition of modern, that you get this weird kind of ambivalent juncture or connection between these two levels of time, and both of them are very similar in their kind of dialectical interplay, and that's what allows them to be in my analysis to be quite naively combined, even though they would seem to be opposed to one another. But each of the chapters adds little things like that. So and I talk about Claude Lefort's description of modernity as this kind of evacuation of the place of power that used to anchor the social in pre-modern times. I talk about theories of nationhood and how that applies to this specific kind of interest in the past and in a national past. That you get with the Pushkin Jubilee, and a lot of other things as well. So, I mean, it has a very specific question to it, but I hope that it's broad enough to be interesting to a lot of people who are looking at these kind of questions about how the modern is being constructed in the interwar period and the Soviet Union, particularly how it is a kind of the way I talk about it, that Stalinism in many ways for me is the kind of, it's, you can look at it as an aberration, as a kind of betrayal of the revolution. And I think, we have to do that in many ways, but it also is kind of an expected outcome, you could say, as the revolutionary state tries to become its own kind of polity, tries to sort of, follow this policy of socialism in one country, and with that to declare itself as a kind of modern state, as some alternative to capitalism, to the West, but also takes things from the West and reshapes them in its own way, purifies them maybe of certain bourgeois contagion. So that's, a lot of what I'm trying to do is show how kind of the way the revolutionary society develops into this particular form in the 1930s is, can be seen as an attempt to kind of solve this impossible task that modernity sets us, this task of sort of simultaneously feeling like we are at the cusp of some epochal moment, that our moment matters in some special way, but also then being conscious of the fact that our moment is just a momentary threshold, between the past and the future. It can be seen as a detailed description of this event, or taking that as a case study for the Stalinist period, the pre-war Stalinist period as a whole, or something even bigger, theoretically, looking at how the discourse of modernity really sends us for loops. That if you really put your mind to it, you can get tangled up in all sorts of interesting doublethink and make some crazy images. So.
Well, there is definitely a lot to talk about here, but probably while we are on the modernity, something I wanted to ask you is that you mentioned at some point in the book that you think that with the Jubilee case, the return to Pushkin was a modernization project, but also a project which demonstrated that Stalinist period had a much more complicated temporal logic to it. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. What were the implications of this modernist project?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. That's kind of what I was just talking about. But, you know, in terms of modernization, a lot of discussion of the Jubilee comes in the context of discussions of a kind of Russocentric turn that you get in the 1930s, which bears, you know, resemblance to a certain kind of turn towards nationalism of one kind or another, although it's very specific in the Soviet case because it still has this imperial structure in many ways. So the general idea is that nationalism goes hand in hand with modernization because it promotes the kind of creation of or the homogenization of society. You start, if you create a literary canon, it means everyone in school is reading the same books, right? If you and through those books, they develop a sort of literary language, a norm for communicating, and this allows people to be more flexible, more mobile in moving around in different industries, for example, that you can kind of expect the same general kind of person as you modernize your country, and instead of having people, you know. Differentiated from one another by dialectical regional differences and so on that are more common in a kind of imperial structure. So in terms of modernization, this monumentalist aspect of the Jubilee would be more would be the thing you would expect more because again, it's like Pushkin becomes this kind of core of value that everyone can return to and derive, a sense of identity from. But by participating in this event, people are, they're basically voting yes to be Russians. And when the non-Russian people do, they're kind of asserting the kind of, in some ways, you could say the universal significance of Russian culture, which is something that you get very common. It's very common with national poet cults that they are simultaneously kind of inclusionary and exclusionary. So they become part of a civilizing mission for the national culture that produces them. So everyone should read Shakespeare, especially our colonies in India. But at the same time, they're exclusionary in the sense that only the people in the core national culture can get every nuance, right? Because it speaks to them in some kind of special way. And you get that very much in the Jubilee, in the Pushkin Jubilee, where there's a certain degree to which the celebration is meant to encourage Russian speakers and ethnic Russians even, but it's more of a cultural thing rather than an ethnic thing. But that Russian culture is, you know, we can now be proud of our heritage, and we can incorporate that into our socialist identity. But at the same time, all the other republics in the Soviet Union should be joining with us in celebration. So that's the modernization thing. But the degree to which I'm saying it's more complicated is that this model only works up to a point, and then you get all these other things that come in. So, for example, even the way they emphasize the importance to Russians, there's this real defensive quality to it, because for a long time in the years before the Jubilee, Russian culture is specifically kind of you have a kind of Terry Martin calls it affirmative action policies, right? That there's this kind of anxiety about any kind of Russian patriotic discourse. That the task is to emphasize diversity in the union, and that while events like the Pushkin Jubilee would seem to suggest a move away from that, you can find all sorts of ways in which a lot of the participants specifically will resist this Russocentric picture of Pushkin. And in some way, Pushkin will be pushed towards a fully universal, totally translatable into any kind of language that, because he's associated with the socialist culture, he kind of goes beyond other national poets as into some kind of, a kind of image that you get once in a while. You'll have this pantheon of great writers and artists that will make up the utopian sort of reading list of world communism, and Pushkin will be the first one in the list. And that's not out of Russian patriotism, but in some ways just because Russia made it to socialism first, and therefore its culture is going to be kind of reshaped and reworked in this very non-monumental fashion, very much about a kind of purging of the past, of its what errors it might have committed and so on, and in order to make it fit with the present. That's basically the logic of the whole thing, is that on the one hand, I'll show how it fits this general model of some kind of interwar modernization project that you get going on. So, like, the Nazis are having a giant celebration of Schiller in 1934. That this is not a specifically Soviet thing that's going on. And in general, the phenomenon of having jubilees for national poets goes back to the 18th century. But that because of this, the revolutionary content of the events, it takes on this kind of this split character, schizophrenic, you could say, but where it's vacillating between these what you would seem to be a more expected legitimizing turn to Pushkin as a monumental figure, and this kind of strange interest in leaping over time and bringing Pushkin back to life in some kind of a radical new form, and imagining him longing for that in the past, and all these different things that they do in order to make that feeling of some kind of specific connection outside of time between Pushkin and the present.
So in your second chapter, you are talking about various pedagogical texts and practices. And is there anything striking you found about the role of Pushkin and place of Pushkin in teaching in the 1930s?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I discovered that I found quite interesting was that literature had always been very problematic in early Soviet education, that in many periods when they tried to push more radical pedagogical agenda, they actually would cut literature. They wouldn't have a chronological sort of history of Russian literature or world literature. They would just use literary texts here and there to illustrate more socioeconomic kind of topics. But then whenever they would find that those utopian kind of radical practices weren't working in some way, that they were too difficult to implement and so on, they would retreat to, using that word retreat, but they would kind of withdraw from that and go to something more traditional and then introduce a literature class, a proper literature class along with that. So literature had this kind of intrinsically conservative quality in the Soviet schools, that like part of what inventing a new school was about would be to get rid of that kind of idea of a literary canon. Which makes sense in terms of all this stuff about monumentalism that I've been talking about, that there's a kind of tendency to want an iconoclastic tendency in early Soviet culture that wants to resist that. But what happens in the Jubilee is that you have this massive kind of intrusion of Pushkin into the schools, and all sorts of performative methods that they do to bring Pushkin to life, right? And a lot of education, pedagogues, pedagogical sort of leaders in the field and so on, were using the events to put forward a kind of new way of doing literature, one that actually isn't that different from things that were going on in the West, and in many ways, which is still, relevant in literature teaching, although at least it was when I was in school. But where you look at books as a kind of an entryway into life, right? That there's a kind of experience of a text that you get that sort of prepares you for real experience. It's a kind of virtual testing ground or something. And what that meant is they had to emphasize emotional response over everything else. So if in earlier times when you would read, and this is even in those more conservative periods when you would read the literary canon, it's filled with all sorts of anxiety about the dangers of these old texts, that they're going to have the wrong ideology and the children are going to get confused. And so the textbooks are filled with all sorts of criticism of the thing that you're reading. So if you can imagine, I mean, how nice it would be to be reading Pushkin and then, you know, the next thing you have to do is learn how to say that he was a, you know, he was an aristocrat and he had, reactionary ideas about the peasants, which you can see in certain works. And after 1825, he became a toady for the czars and so on. And then you're supposed to also at the same time be reading this stuff and getting something out of it. That was finally put to bed in the 30s, around the time of the Jubilee, around when the first announcement of the Jubilee came out in 1935. Already in 34, it started even earlier, but the main campaign in the school starts at the end of 35. These methods that they would use, all these different kinds, you know, this kind of embodying the text through, this выразительное чтение, this expressive reading, doing all sorts of art projects, theatrical productions. You get kind of bizarre things like, I have this one picture of a gymnastics thing where they spell, the kids get into positions spelling out Pushkin's name. And you get all of this kind of, the way I talk about it is in terms of a kind of, the students are turned into these kind of militant, kind of figures who are resurrecting Pushkin. Like that's their main task, is sort of using their passion and their dedication and their, enthusiasm for socialism to rescue Pushkin from the dark past and all those dangerous things that would have been criticized in, 5-10 years before, just to kind of lift him out of that darkness and shower him with socialist love, transforming him. So, the use of these kind of practices, these kind of performative pedagogical practices, and especially jubilees, really, became a standard method and allowed for, in general, for the reintroduction of more traditional literary historical curriculum, because you could constantly, perforate that the study of literature as history with these kind of performative resurrective activities, right? So you learn about Pushkin, but then you make a model of the duel where you kind of and it fills you with such sadness to see him about to get shot that you are sort of drawn to rescue Pushkin from the duel, rip him out of the model, and so on, and put him somewhere else. But anyway, so that's the kind of thing that they found a technique that allowed them to kind of get over the old anxieties about canonical literature, and it really had a major impact on how things were taught in school. Now, of course, the militant passion of the Soviet Union doesn't last very long after the war, and a lot of these things become exactly what people who remember the Soviet Union consider to be like the most mind-numbing aspects of Soviet education, memorizing poems and things like that, and having to, make these albums putting newspaper clippings and so on into albums for Jubilee dates. The idea was progressive at the time and was seen as a way to sort of brew militancy in the children specifically, in this case specifically with regard to the pre-revolutionary literary past. So,
and how about the intellectuals? You write in chapter 3 about the academic writing about Pushkin, and it seems that the scholars also had some problems, situating Pushkin in the temporality, and you bring Vinogradov as one of the more successful examples of it.
Yeah, well, Vinogradov is weird because he, basically the way I talk about it, his two-volume, you know, his massive two-volume book on Pushkin's language and Pushkin's style is that he really has this kind of nationalist, monumentalist approach, right? And it's completely, it's not actually tempered with anything, any of this other stuff, this relevance of Pushkin for our times. He's not talking about why Pushkin is relevant to socialist society because he really, you know, he says, you know, I'm writing about the Russian national poet and what he did with the Russian language, and that is something that will be relevant for all times, and no matter what shape our you know, country takes. And, you know, and he got persecuted. He was, you know, accused of nationalist sort of connections, of a right-wing sort of heresy in a fabricated case. But, you know, there's clearly, you know, some truth to the association of him with that kind of thinking. But I use him kind of as a setup for the people that I'm more interested in, who do try to address this, who do try to bring in this alternative temporality, this more eschatological temporality based on rupture and association of the past with the present. So there, my main the main sort of theoretical sort of addition is Rancière. And this idea of modern literature as having as practicing a different kind of politics, which you find in various people like Lydia Ginsborg writing in the 30s around the time of the Jubilee, and some other people, you get this willing this sort of what would have been rare, very rare, or even impossible in previous years, this willingness to say that Pushkin was not a political poet, right, primarily. That, in fact, he withdraws from politics after 1825, you know, separates himself from the Decembrists in order to produce a kind of aesthetic vision that has a different kind of political efficacy or significance, which is, you know, interesting, very similar to the kind of things that Rancière says. So in terms of temporality, the way it works out usually is that withdrawal that Pushkin has to make from the sort of politics of wills, the politics of sort of trying to influence, you know, the state specifically, or even, overthrow the Tsar, that you get with the Decembrists and with their poetry, that Pushkin withdraws from that into this more kind of flat. I mean, generally the way it's talked about is that you can, that the, instead of having a hierarchical genre system or a hierarchy of different styles, that you get this kind of single vision of things, and anything can be incorporated into a literary work, regardless of its sort of its high, its sort of loftiness or its baseness. And that you get this kind of democratic vision that has a political quality to it, in the fact, simply from the fact that it is no longer supporting a kind of hierarchy of styles and of types of speech. So the idea, though, is that for Pushkin, that comes as a kind of tragedy, that he experiences this, this withdrawal from politics as part of the tragedy of his life, and that, you know, he's you know, increasingly sort of finds himself increasingly embroiled in different contradictions and so on. But then that tragedy has this revolutionary potential because we are the fulfillment of it. We are the redemption of that past. So in some ways, Pushkin creates this modern vision, this democratic vision, but it actually isolates him from society, because his society is so backwards that it can't sort of take advantage of it. But we are, now that the workers are liberated and the workers know how to read, or peasants, for that matter, that moment of aesthetic innovation, or whatever you want to call it, is finally being realized as its political efficacy is finally being realized today. So in the way that that we read it. So it's kind of similar thing. It's, you know, focusing on this. I mean, the eschatological part really tends to focus on how the builders of socialism, how the contemporary Soviet reader how that presence, this kind of this encounter between Pushkin and the Soviet reader is itself transformative of Pushkin. And you get that in scholarly works as in the things people were doing in schools. So.
And how about visual arts, performance, or film? So how did the image of Pushkin arise in these genres during the Jubilee celebrations?
Mm-hmm. I talk about a lot of different things. I talk about paintings and monumental sculpture, historical novels, historical films that were made for the Jubilee. There's some plays that I talk about, poetry, lyric poetry as well. Each thing has a slightly different set of questions associated with it. For example, the question of monumental sculpture, that generally you have this tendency to kind of resist the very, you know, the kind of essence of a monument, which is its permanence and its sort of stasis, as this kind of, this object that the people gather around and focus their attention on, giving them a kind of collective identity. Instead, the kind of monuments of Pushkin that were popular, and they had a lot of competitions to design a new monuments, none of which were actually realized. But they show Pushkin moving in various ways, like he's windswept, or I mean, it's recognizable from from Stalinist from Soviet sculpture generally, especially from the later part of the 30s, when you get a little bit more things get a little more windswept. If you think of Worker and Collective Farm Girl or something, there's that, this kind of weird need to make the monument itself look like it's kind of it's alive and not and moving and not just a static fixed image. And they have all sorts of different ways of talking about how that could be achieved. None of them really are convincing visually, but the discourse itself is fascinating. You get other things. I mean, in painting, you get a similar problem where you have a lot of historical portraits of Pushkin, try to show him in this kind of moment of confrontation with the tragedy that I was talking about before. Right. Or so like he will, you have a painting where he meets Dantes in the Letni Sad or something. And he's just kind of appears all shocked and frozen. And they, what's interesting is that the critics would always attack these kinds of paintings because they drain the life out of Pushkin's face or something. They have this kind of fascination with how you would make Pushkin's living features directly visible to viewers today. And people tried some really weird things. There's this one painting by this woman, Nadezhda Radlova, where she paints Pushkin with this really broad, toothy smile, standing on the Neva embankment. And he looks basically like he's posing for a photograph. So you get this very anachronistic feeling, even though he's dressed in his, you know, Pushkinian garb with his hat and cane and everything. It looks like he's smiling directly at us. And so it's these similar tensions. That you're trying attempts to do a portraiture, attempts to reflect history, to embed us in Pushkin's own time, but at the same time, some kind of attempt, usually unsuccessful, but what matters is the fact that it's there, to make the image resonate with the present, to make it have some kind of memory of the future, you could say, right? Some kind of sense that of how things are going to change and how things will be transformed. The best is this painting by blanking on his name, Ulyanov. I think, although that's Lenin. Anyway, doesn't matter. It's a famous painting that probably everyone has seen, where Pushkin is sort of standing in front of a mirror with his wife at a ball, and he's dressed in his Kammerjunker uniform, and you have in the reflection in the mirror the staircase kind of going up with all these sort of grandees, you know, court figures, kind of glaring at Pushkin with great hostility. And Pushkin is kind of turning his head, and you see like one eye as he's turning back. And the eye is, of course, looking at the viewer. But, you know, technically he's looking at these guys that we see in the mirror. But it creates this very strange effect where it's like it's almost like he's looking back at us and sharing his disgust at these people with the contemporary viewer of the painting. And it creates this very weird effect where his head is kind of the only thing that has proper perspective. Everything else is kind of more flattened by the mirror effect. But, you know, it ends up looking like this mirror is a painting within the painting. And we're sharing in this kind of effect of fused horizons where like Pushkin and us, we know, we're in the know about how terrible these lackeys of the Tsar were. So you get all sorts of things like that. I separated basically. I talk about, visual imagery. Well, not visual imagery, but sort of, static imagery versus time-based imagery. So I put film and historical novels together, whereas the monuments and the paintings are in a separate chapter. But when you get into the historical stuff, it becomes a lot more difficult to create that fusion of horizons, because you would have to kind of put a contemporary figure back in the history somehow. Because if you're trying to actually show the evolution of Pushkin as a character, as a historical figure, it's quite difficult. So, and what happens there that I talk about is Pushkin ends up getting the tragedy comes to the fore, that you feel that he's stranded there. That's kind of, they do it through negation, basically, that you get this feeling that Pushkin is kind of caught in this this backwards time and desperately needs to be rescued. And then the film or the novel will end usually with just that feeling that we, you know, that Pushkin is moving forward, but he's moving forward towards us, who will be the, you know, the final redemption of all the horrible stuff that he had to go through. So let
me ask one last question about the book. In your final chapter, you're sort of giving a reader a ride through 20th century Russian literature, showing how the memory and the legacy of the Jubilee persisted in it. So maybe you could summarize some important points of the journey for us, and also talk about your meeting with Prigov, which was a very exciting episode in that chapter.
Oh, you mean from the preface, the Prigov? Well, yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, my general, you know, approach to Stalinist culture is that the, you know, like I said before, the militant energy of the revolution basically doesn't last beyond the war. That, you know, late Stalinist culture is a very different animal from Stalinist culture in the 30s, that you kind of lose this, this willingness, this militant kind of passion. Basically meaning that you're willing to kind of go the distance in exploring these kind of crazy things, like this attempt to fuse these different attitudes to time that you get on the Jubilee. And so instead what you get, so I talk about some sort of 70s era writing by Trifon Levin-Iskandier about their own childhood. They're quite biographical texts about their own childhood and the and experience of the Jubilee, and how this knowledge of the kind of the stale, the way official culture became so stale after the war, colors the memory of those of the events, and focuses. So, like in Trifonov's case, he focuses specifically on this. The kid in the story has to make a Pushkin album for the Jubilee, and he's ruining books, cutting out pictures from books, but then the glue he has is bad, and it kind of seeps through the pictures and it looks terrible, and then he like misspells something, you know, and he gets no prize or respect for his project. But then this is linked to, it comes to him in the book as a flashback. The book is Isheznavenie, Disappearance, which is part of it is about his father getting persecuted during the purges. But it's a flashback from where he's in during the war, where he's like painting, banners or slogans or something. And he also makes a spelling mistake. But during the war, I think it's his sister or someone is there with him, says like, no one's even going to notice. No one even looks at these slogans anymore. So you get this kind of weird image of a person who was actually, you know, really invested in the Pushkin Jubilee, who was like wanted to get a prize, wanted to do these things that they were telling him to do. But it was too difficult, that there was some kind of, that you couldn't produce these hybrid structures without, you know, incredible kind of, you know, without, you know, I mean, it's true of even the elite works, that everything is kind of failing as it tries to produce these hybrid structures. It's very rare that you get works that actually succeed in doing it. And that creates a lot of suffering in the person who is actually, following this kind of militant model and is trying to do what you're supposed to do, and resurrect the past and you know, redeem the tragedy and all these different things. But if you fail to do it, you feel pretty bad. So you get this. So basically, you know, the idea is that after the war itself, you know, this, and maybe probably already during it, you get people are, you know, not willing to put that kind of investment into things. Because you know it's just not nice when it backfires, so it becomes stale, it becomes more ritualized, and so on. And then I kind of move forward to the conceptualist, like to Putigov, as this kind of weird inverse kind of still militant, tendency where they kind of it's almost like the Stalinist. You know, the moment when Stalinism was still really alive in the 1930s, it's really been lost. It's been forgotten because of all this decline in militancy that you get in the, you know, 30, 40 years between. Putigov is basically sort of, it's like he's discovering these little bits of Pushkin imagery and picking them up and sort of identifying himself with them. The story I kind of even fits with that, because basically when I was writing my master's thesis with Kathy Nepomniachtchi at Columbia, I was focusing at that time on the pedagogical stuff, on how Pushkin changed the way literature was taught in the schools. And Kathy had this thing where like you always had to get native informants for any project, because it's important to know these people in the first place, but also you want to, you know, get around and with your ideas and so on. It was Kathy, it was, you know, the best idea was always to interview famous people. So she had me interview Putigov when he was staying at her house, because he'd come to Columbia for a reading. And I didn't even know who he was really at the time. It was like my first year in graduate school. And so I was just using him as a native informant and asking him how he what he remembered about studying Pushkin in school. And he was like, really didn't understand what was going on. And he was like, I didn't read Pushkin. I played with tanks and airplanes, you know, like other little boys. What are you talking about? And then it finally got so frustrated that he just started reciting his Pushkin poems. And that it's kind of interesting because I was asking him to take this kind of metaposition, towards his biography, and sort of just, you know, to tell this story of you know, or of history, of Soviet history and so on. But the truth is, what it has to be kind of embodied. It has to be a performance of these peculiar, this peculiar kind of signifier that Pushkin becomes in the Stalinist period. It becomes kind of like this. He is doing a similar thing to what the children do in effect during the Jubilee, as a kind of militant. He's sort of bringing this dead Stalinist signifier back to life in his Pushkin poems. So, and, you know, and then, you know, I talk about Mamin's film Buchenbarde, Sideburns, where you get a kind of that idea of playing, of playful identification, over-identification that we associate with still loses its kind of slipperiness and it no longer functions. So you have in that film this interesting moment when the main character who has been, you know, dressing up as Pushkin and getting other people to join a kind of paramilitary Pushkin organization to take over this town, that the newspaper prints, like they end up beating up the people at a demonstration, and the newspaper compares him to Hitler, and it makes him cry because, in a sense, this identification, this over-identification with Pushkin, it's always meant to be both serious and ironic. Right? This is the nature of Stjob, that you can't position yourself clearly. You don't know if the performance is a performance or not, right? It's so overdone that it has the effect of seeming like it's actually something super serious. But if once you say, like, ah, these guys are actually fascists, they are real fascists, then it's like its whole structure kind of falls apart, because you have to maintain this kind of deadpan irony alongside of it for it to work, which is the same thing that you get with pretty good poetry. So I talk about that because that film is from 1990, that this is a kind of nostalgia or a kind of, you know, mourning the end of this underground culture that was, you know, no longer really feasible during perestroika. Otherwise, you know, I looked at some contemporary textbooks in Russia, and how it's interesting that you'll find little fragments of the old Stalinist discourse sometimes appearing in schools today, like with just the memory of these phrases was so ingrained in people over the years that they kind of just appear unattributed in contemporary textbooks without any kind of consciousness of their Stalinist context. But I generally, my look at contemporary Russian textbooks suggests that they're not, at least when I was doing it, this was during the kind of the mini thaw that you had in the Medvedev presidency, they weren't pursuing this kind of hybrid temporal structure anymore, that it was pretty monumentalist, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And it would be interesting to go back and see if anything's changed, because I know they've recently been redoing a lot of textbooks again, most notably in history. But it'd be interesting to see if their approach to literature has changed with the new kind of radicalization you've been getting in Russian politics. But.
And what are you working on at the moment? Do you continue to work on Pushkin, or are you doing a different project altogether?
I have a couple things going on simultaneously now, but my biggest project is actually quite similar to the Pushkin project, but it's about Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya. So it's another kind of cultural analysis of a kind of icon that was celebrated specifically, but this time moving forward and looking at the war. And a little bit more on how, you know, this image of a militant was kind of cleansed and domesticated after the war, specifically in terms of gender. So Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya becomes this, even though she has this androgynous kind of Joan of Arc quality in the original representations of her, she is increasingly feminized as time goes on. She becomes this kind of disciplinary tool rather than a kind of model of the ecstasy of giving yourself to the cause, that kind of thing. And then in that project, I also bring it up to the contemporary moment. Probably about half the book is going to be about contemporary attitudes towards the figure of Kosmodemyanskaya in the war. And the image of the Soviet militant. So I went around Russia and interviewed all sorts of people who are the sort of memory keepers who, you know, maintain museums dedicated to Kosmodemyanskaya or write about her still, or you know, work in archives and so on. And interviewing them about their you know, their feelings about contemporary Russia and whether or not this image of Zoya is still relevant or why it's not relevant, what has changed, and things like that. So I talked to those people in the one, and then I did some projects with some contemporary leftist artists in Russia about Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya, where they are kind of, you know, they want, and many of them want to identify with her, to identify with this militant image, but they're nervous because of the not just the way the Soviet Union used images like this, but specifically the contemporary moment in Russia where the war has become this this very you know, it's become the foundation of society in many ways, and it's the used as how you define who your enemies and who your friends are and things like that. So that's my main project. I write articles when I can about Pushkin's own works, usually in terms of intertextual things, either Pushkin reworking things from the Western tradition, or sometimes people who come after Pushkin kind of manipulating his images and motifs to, in different ways. And I, you know, I work a bit on contemporary Russian poetry, and I've done some other contemporary Russian art stuff. I've been translating this poet Galina Rimbu for a couple of years now, and the translations have been really popular and published in a lot of different places. And I just got an offer to put it all together into a book.
Congratulations!
So that's pretty
exciting. That sounds terrific.
Yeah, so got a lot going on. That's the bulk of it right now. Trying to keep my head above water with all these different things.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with all of your projects, and thank you very much for being with us today on New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jonathan Brooks Platt, author of Greetings Pushkin, Stalinist Cultural Politics, and the Russian National Bard. Please join us again in 2 weeks for a new episode of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And until then, this was your host, Olga Breininger. Take care.